for even the lapse of 3 days, as you talked about in the last episode or previous episodes, that we need at least a minimum requirement of 3 days,
3 days
to call a woman experiencing menstruation as menstrual blood and as to be in the state of haze, right? But this bleeding happens to be like less than three days. So, and she stops, for example, performing prayer or her daily obligation.
Yes, all right? You're right.
And what should she do now? Because, for example, for about 2 days, all right? Yes.
She missed,
she missed her prayer.
Her prayers, yes. Well, as I said, the period of haiz, menstruation, is not less than 3 days. Now, if a woman discharges blood for 2 days and a half, and it is less than 3 days, obviously, so she has to make up all the prayers that she did not offer, and she has to make up for the fast that she did not observe. And of course, as you know, a woman in the state of haiz is not supposed to offer prayers, and there's no qadha also. There's no qadha for a woman who does not offer prayers during menstruation. I think this is one of the advantages of getting a blood discharge, and women do not offer prayers, or maybe you can call it at a kind of disadvantage, because they are not going to offer prayers. They are kind of forgiven, but a woman who experiences the blood discharge for less than 3 days, even if it is by a measure of, let's say, 1 hour, less than 1 hour, then that woman should consider herself as a woman having had istihaza, not menstrual blood.
Yes.
And so she must give the qadha of her prayers. She has to give the qadha of her fast if she had discharge, irregular discharge in the month of Ramadan.
I see. Thank you very much. Sheikh Javid, you said that, you know, in one of the previous episodes, that, you know, when you were talking about characteristics of some of the signs of the blood of the menses. For example, you said that it's warm, it comes out with irritation, it's dark, you know?
Yes.
And these features. So what if the blood that a woman or a girl experiences lacks those signs for some days, but it's continuous?
Yes.
All right? So what about this? The blood could be yellowish or brownish.
Of course. According to Ayatollah Sistani, the yellowish discharge which is seen by a woman in the beginning of her period is not termed as the blood of haiz. It is not considered as menstrual blood. Okay, the yellowish or the brownish discharge which is seen by a woman before her menstrual blood start flowing or coming out, that's not considered to be a part of haiz. But as I explained in the previous episode, the yellowish discharge which is seen after the monthly period, for example, she sees the blood on the fifth or the sixth day, but the blood does not have those signs of the monthly blood. Like, for example, it is yellowish, it's not warm, it does not come with irritation, and it's not dark. Of course, it could be very light red, it could be yellowish in color. This is considered to be a part of haiz, provided that it does not exceed 10 days. It does not flow out for more than 10 days. If it comes out for more than 10 days, of course, that's not considered to be haiz.
I see.
The office of Ayatollah Sistani is currently providing the following services. 1. Board of Istifta, replying to religious questions. 2. Helping the poor, needy, homeless, and those who have suffered losses by earthquakes and floods. 3. Sending books for people who want to understand and learn Islam. 4. Hajj delegation. 5. Sending preachers. Board of Istifta is a link between Ayatollah Sistani and people. It provides them with answers to questions pertaining to religious, ideological, social, and educational matters in accordance with the verdicts and rulings of Ayatollah Sistani. For more information, visit the website of Ayatollah Sistani at www.sistani.org. You can also ask your questions through the following email, english@sistani.org.
What if that the woman is in doubt, in fact, as to whether her period has ended or not? What should she do?
Yes, a woman who suspects that she might still be in the state of menstruation
or not,
of course, she has to check herself. Every woman can check herself by inserting something, a piece of cotton or something like maybe tampons, I don't know, there is a kind of
tampons.
And these are the things she can insert into her vagina and see whether there is any blood on the surface of the cotton or not. If there is blood, then she can rest assured that she is still menstruating and she has to avoid offering prayers and also fasting, okay? But if there is no blood, then she must take action for the ritual ablution. She has to perform ghusl haid and get ready for prayer and everything else.
When you say that the women should check themselves through any means they have available to themselves, like a piece of swabs or cotton,
sure,
or whatever,
yeah,
you know, and you see that if they see a blood stain, they could make sure that this is the menstruation,
yeah,
or the continuation of the menstruation. But what about the color of this blood?
The color can be yellowish, the color
brownish.
Because I said that,
yes,
the color which is brownish or yellowish, after the close to the end of the menstrual period, is still considered to be a part of haiz. It is part of the monthly discharge, provided that it does not exceed 10 days.
I see. All right. When the woman knows that she has haid, all right?
Yeah.
What are the things that are permissible for her to do? Because you talked about some of the, you know, activities or rituals that she's not allowed to do.
Yes.
All right. Of course, you mentioned to some, but you can also, if there are any more,
yes,
tell us and tell our audience that what are the things that she can do and what are the things that she cannot do.
That's a good question. I think we need to discuss it. Maybe if we cannot discuss it in full length, of course, we have to discuss it in the next episode, because
okay,
this is one of the important questions.
Yes.
Some Indian women, of course, and of course I include also the Pakistani and Bangladeshi women, they think, because I read their emails that they send to Ayatollah Sistani's office, they are of the view that when a woman gets her period, then she becomes impure. She is impure. She cannot touch anything. She cannot cook anything. Yes, and she cannot touch even her towel, that she can, which otherwise, if she can use, if she were not in this state of, so she has. She should make sure that she does not touch anything.
I see.
And if she, and if her body comes in contact with the bed sheet, she should wash it. She should wash it. And she should put away, take off her clothes after she stops bleeding, because everything that comes in contact with her body becomes impure. That is a misconception, and I want to tell our audience that that's not true. ritual impurity does not mean that you are essentially impure. That the person who enters the state of janaba, or the state of janaba or nifas, or let's say haiz, becomes essentially impure, like a dog or like a pig, like anything which is essentially impure. Okay.
Yes.
She is ritually impure. She can touch everything. She can touch. She can cook. She can enter majalis, go attend majalis. She can go to Imam Barga or Husayniyas, and she can even read the Holy Quran, which is the holiest book. Okay.
Except the verses for the.
Of course, except those four
that
verses.
That require prostration.
Except those four verses which contain obligatory sajda.
Yes.
Those are the four verses which a woman cannot recite.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, Sheikh. And inshallah, we are going to continue on this question in the next episode. Thank you very much for listening to us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Rahmanun Rahimun Mannanun Kareemun Salamun Aleemun Majalilaha illahum Ghaffar
Limelight.
Donald Trump on Sunday launched his attempted political comeback, teasing a possible run for the presidency in 2024 and denouncing current President Joe Biden for the most disastrous first month of any president in modern history. The former president made his first speech since leaving the White House at the right-wing Conservative Political Action Conference, or CPAC, in Orlando, Florida, to an effusive reception. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian columnist David Smith. The piece is titled CPAC, Pent-Up Trump Denounces Biden at Right-Wing Summit. Stay with us for more of David Smith's article. Donald Trump on Sunday launched his attempted political comeback, teasing a possible run for the presidency in 2024 and denouncing Joe Biden for the most disastrous first month of any president in modern history. The former president made his first speech since leaving the White House at the right-wing Conservative Political Action Conference, or CPAC, in Orlando, Florida, to an effusive reception. Trump claimed, entirely falsely, that he actually won the 2020 presidential election, but was fraudulently denied his victory. He told CPAC the Democrats just lost the White House, despite the fact that Joe Biden was inaugurated as the 46th President of the United States on 20th of January, sworn in by the Supreme Court Chief Justice John Roberts, and officials at all levels called the election the most secure in U.S. history. Trump said to wild cheers, "I may even decide to beat them for a third time." The twice impeached ex-president unleashed pent-up frustration after 2 months of social media silence. He was banned by both Facebook and Twitter for incendiary comments, and just a handful of television interviews. Donald Trump made it clear he intends to remain a political force by declaring, "I stand before you today to declare that the incredible journey we began together 4 years ago is far from over. We all knew that the Biden administration was going to be bad, but none of us imagined just how bad they would be," and how far left they would go. Joe Biden has had the most disastrous first month of any president in modern history. Donald Trump added, Biden's radical immigration policies aren't just illegal, they're immoral, they're heartless, and they are a betrayal of our nation's core values. Donald Trump also called on Joe Biden to reopen schools despite ongoing safety fears due to the coronavirus pandemic. The former president also invoked his America First nationalist agenda by insisting, "We believe in standing up to China, shutting down outsourcing, bringing back our factories and supply chains, and ensuring that America, not China, dominates the future." In a speech that lasted about 90 minutes, Donald Trump fell back on his reliable right-wing themes against immigration, especially dealing harshly with migrants crossing the U.S.-Mexico border, and talking up his barrier strengthening there. He also took off on a transphobic rant, claiming that transgender athletes were ruining women's sports. And Donald Trump positioned himself at the presumed heart of the Republican Party, saying, any idea that he was going to lead a breakaway political party was fake news. Despite the recent bipartisan vote at his impeachment trial, where he escaped conviction, Trump claims the Republican Party is united. The only division is between a handful of Washington, D.C. establishment political hacks and everybody else all over the country. Most commentators expect Donald Trump, age 74, to leave open the possibility that he will run for re-election in 2024 without making a definitive commitment. He has remained a looming presence at CPAC, with speaker after speaker pledging fealty to him and his Make America Great Again agenda, while a golden calf-style idol in his image was even paraded around the convention halls. Numerous speakers and panels have also indulged and prompted Donald Trump's brazen lie that the election was stolen from him. Matt Schlapp, chair of the American Conservative Union, which runs the conference, claimed, CPAC is your first opportunity to see what actually happened on Election Day, and there was widespread voter fraud in way too many states, most especially in big cities run by the Democratic machine. That is fact, and we gave you evidence to underscore that fact. Tom Fitton, president of the right-wing group Judicial Watch, told attendees, on Election Day, President Trump had the votes to win the presidency. These vote totals were changed because of unprecedented and extraordinary counting after Election Day. Judicial Watch has long warned of the chaos and increased risk of fraud from recklessly mailing 100 million ballots and ballot applications. Such claims have repeatedly been proved false. Mail-in voting surged because of the coronavirus pandemic, but state officials, including Republicans, reported no significant irregularities in the vote. The former president and his allies lost more than 60 legal challenges, including those weighed by Trump-appointed judges. Donald Trump's own Attorney General, William Barr, dismissed the fraud allegations. The former president rounded off his speech with another tease about his future ambitions, telling the crowd, with your help, we will take back the White House. We will win the Senate, and then a Republican president will make a triumphant return to the White House. And I wonder who that will be. I wonder who that will be. Who will that be? I wonder. Earlier on Sunday, 28th of February, the Republican Congressman Jim Jordan said of Trump, the leader of the conservative movement, the leader of the America First movement, the leader of the Republican Party, and I hope on 20th of January 2025, he will be once again the leader of our great country. But the annual CPAC straw poll found that only 55% of attendees actually want Donald Trump to be the Republican presidential nominee in 2024, ahead of Florida Governor Ron DeSantis at 21%. The conference, the CPAC conference, of course, was held in Florida. South Dakota Governor Kristi Noem at 4%, and former South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley at 3%. Evan McMullen, Executive Director of Stand Up Republic and a former presidential candidate, tweeted in response, "It's still Donald Trump's party, but there's a growing number ready for something new." Meanwhile, for all the talk of party unity, CPAC was notable for the absence of former Vice President Mike Pence and absence of Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell and a number of other leading Republicans. Bill Cassidy, a Republican senator from Louisiana, insisted that CPAC does not represent the entire Republican Party. Bill Cassidy said, "Now, if we plan to win in midterm elections in 2022, and a presidential election in 2024, we have to listen to the voters, not just those who really like President Trump, but also those who perhaps are less sure," he told CNN's State of the Union program. Cassidy added, "If we idolize one person, we will lose, and that's kind of clear from the last election."
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
On September 11, 2001, two hijacked airplanes were flown into the twin World Trade Center buildings, killing almost 3,000 people. Soon after, then-President George W. Bush announced that time has come for the world to come together and fight a war against all those who seek to export terror. That announcement gave birth to the first war of the 21st century, the so-called War on Terror. 20 years after the invasion of Afghanistan by the U.S.-led forces, the U.S. counterterrorism operations have only expanded. A recent report published by the Costs of War Project at Brown University's Watson Institute and USA Today shows that despite the talk of refocusing on great power competition, counterterrorism policy of Washington has not changed. According to the report, the U.S. military has been in over 85 countries in the past 3 years. U.S. troops have conducted bombing or ground attacks in 10 countries, including Afghanistan, Yemen, Syria, Iraq, Kenya, Libya, Mali, Nigeria, Pakistan, and Somalia over the same period. Washington also owns nearly 800 offshore military bases on all six continents. That's while China, as the biggest competitor of the U.S., has only one official overseas military base in Djibouti. Another report by the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute, SIPRI, revealed that the U.S. spent over $732 billion on national defense in 2019. That was more than the next 10 countries combined. The forever war has lasted for two decades, to the tune of $6.4 trillion, resulting in calls on Washington to reassess its policies, as there are doubts whether the benefits to U.S. security outweigh the costs. The ongoing war has taken a heavy toll, as over 15,000 U.S. troops and contractors, nearly 12,500 allied troops, 177,000 national military and police officers, 1,300 journalists and humanitarian aid workers, and nearly 336,000 civilians have lost their lives, while only 260,000 enemy fighters have been killed. Some estimates put the total number of people killed as a result of the war on terror at around 2 million.
The U.S. has nothing positive to show for this two decades of terror and violence around the globe. What it does have to show for it is increased hostility toward the United States everywhere, which of course justifies, in the minds of U.S. government officials, the purchase of more military equipment and more interference.
Back in 2019, during a foreign policy speech, Democratic presidential nominee Joe Biden urged the ending of forever wars, saying that it has cost dearly for the U.S. However, Biden is linked to people who have strong ties to the military industry that is driving this war. Over 8 out of 23 picks for the Department of Defense Agency review team by Biden were linked to organizations, think tanks, or companies which were directly funded by the weapons industry or were part of it. Interestingly, 3 of those 8 were employed in the Center for Strategic and International Studies, which receives funding from Lockheed Martin, Boeing, Northrop Grumman, Raytheon Technologies, and General Dynamics, as well as other weapons manufacturers and oil companies. Lockheed Martin, Boeing, Northrop Grumman, Raytheon Technologies, and General Dynamics account for over 50% of the industry's lobbying. Defense companies spend millions every year lobbying politicians and donating their campaigns. That will ease the way for them to sell their missiles and guns and other equipment to countries around the world. Just 200 defense companies reported lobbying the federal government in the year 2020.
We definitely are. These are people who think war is the way of resolving any perceived problem that the United States has with any other nation. Diplomacy is not something that they have any respect or regard for whatsoever. This is proven in the various ways they have dealt with the situation throughout their careers.
The post-9/11 wars seem to be endless, and the latest figures and statistics approve that notion. Despite President Joe Biden's claims of ending the war, it seems the gulf between his words and reality is too wide. While defense contractors lobby for selling their arms and weapon industry lobbyists become Joe Biden advisors, isn't Biden administration then a war administration?
On Thursday, the United States carried out airstrikes against facilities belonging to anti-terror resistance groups on the Iraqi-Syrian border. White House spokeswoman Jen Psaki said the raid authorized by Biden had been, quote, deliberate and meant to de-escalate the overall situation in both eastern Syria and Iraq. The military action was said to be in retaliation for recent attacks against American bases and missions in Iraq, which Washington has blamed on so-called Iran-backed Iraqi resistance groups. In the latest such attacks, rockets hit Baghdad's Green Zone, which houses the U.S. Embassy and other missions, on Monday. The American military base at the Erbil International Airport had similarly been attacked days earlier. The Iraqi resistance groups and many Iraqi officials have, however, roundly dismissed Washington's allegations, blaming rogue elements. Pro-Western media outlets describe the U.S. air raid on the Iraq-Syria border as a signal to Iran, which they claim is using Iraq's PMU as a, quote, proxy force in the neighboring country, allegations that Tehran has categorically denied.
Joe Biden is a neocon. He has surrounded himself in his foreign policy, his national security advisor, Secretary of State, Ambassador to the United Nations, the Pentagon, has surrounded himself with the same cast of characters to a very large degree who took care of foreign policy during both the Clinton administration and the Obama administration. This is a very aggressive group.
Damascus has slammed the U.S. air raid as a cowardly act of aggression, describing it as a bad sign from the administration of the new president, Joe Biden. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman, Saeed Khatibzadeh, also condemned the U.S. attack as a continuation of raids carried out by Israel on Syria in violation of international law. U.S. President Joe Biden's order to attack the Iraqi anti-terrorism groups on the border with Syria has been criticized both at home and abroad. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov said on Friday that the United States had notified Moscow of the impending attack on the PMU facility 4 or 5 minutes ahead of time. The Russian Foreign Minister said the U.S. military is present on the Syrian soil illegally in violation of all norms of international law, including Security Council resolutions on the reconciliation in the Syrian Arab Republic. He said Russia had received unconfirmed information that the U.S. is planning to stay in Syria indefinitely. Meanwhile, the Chinese Foreign Ministry also reacted to the U.S. air raid, warning against any action that further complicates the situation in the crisis-hit Syria. Also, a number of Democratic U.S. lawmakers have found faults with the legal justifications of President Joe Biden's administration for the airstrikes, demanding that the officials at the White House immediately brief Congress on the matter. Many expected the Biden era to mark a departure from the damaging and warmongering approach of the Trump administration. It now appears that Biden is following the footsteps of the former president.
Really, Joe Biden has a career as a neocon who supported the Iraq war and the invasion and occupation of Iraq when he was in the Senate and in a very influential position as the head of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. As the vice president, he was personally tasked with dealing with the coup in Ukraine and the overthrow of the government, the constitution of a new government that would meet the needs or demands of Washington. And we could go on and on. I mean, going back to wars in Central America in the 1980s, Trump, when some of the liberals who follow and support Biden said when Trump ordered the missiles fired into Syria early in his presidency, they declared that's what made him presidential. So I guess, you know, we have to take it that making war is what makes a U.S. president a real president.
Biden authorized the attack in another sovereign state in his second month in office. Does he really have a change in the U.S. foreign policy in mind? Or are there more conflicts to come?
The world will never forget the gruesome assassination of dissident Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi. The outspoken critic of the Saudi regime was killed and dismembered inside the Saudi consulate in Istanbul in October 2018. Shortly after the killing, the U.S. Central Intelligence Agency assessed with high confidence that Saudi Arabia's de facto ruler, Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, had personally ordered the assassination. The case turned into a severe political storm, triggering global condemnation of the Saudis. However, then U.S. President Donald Trump chose to stand with the notorious Crown Prince and rejected calls to condemn him. Trump's White House dismissed intelligence that bin Salman personally ordered the killing. The former American president made no secret of what was behind his unrelenting support for bin Salman. Trump stressed that he did not want to sacrifice billions of dollars in U.S. arms sales to Saudi Arabia over the matter. The previous U.S. administration blocked the release of the intelligence community's findings into the killing. Trump's successor, Joe Biden, is apparently taking a different course. Biden said during a presidential campaign rally that Khashoggi was murdered and that he believes the Crown Prince ordered the hit. His administration is now releasing a declassified version of a top-secret intelligence report that singles out the Saudi crown prince for at least giving the go-ahead for the assassination, if not directly ordering it. Biden has pledged to take a tough line on Saudi Arabia's human rights violations and its war on Yemen.
Biden, I think, is signaling MBS and the world that the United States is getting back on board as a leader in diplomacy, as a world leader. And you're not going to be those things if you're led around the world by the nose by a Saudi feudal prince. That's got to change. Didn't change under Trump. Didn't change under Obama. I hope to see Biden change that.
The new U.S. administration has made some policy changes regarding Saudi Arabia. U.S. President Joe Biden has ended American support for offensive operations in the Saudi-led war in Yemen and has freezed the sales of weapons to the kingdom. These are not looking very bright for the relationship between the two allies, at least for now. The release of the report on the assassination of Khashoggi is expected to further strain the ties between the two sides. However, during a call with the Saudi king on Thursday, Biden told Salman that he would work for bilateral ties as strongly and transparently as possible. Biden and top administration officials have stressed that they are committed to Saudi Arabia's security. Biden has been in office for a little more than a month, and it is definitely too soon to judge his decisions. The Saudi kingdom is right now a major foreign policy dilemma for the White House. Even if Biden is willing to punish the Saudis for their rights violations and destabilizing actions like their war in Yemen, the road ahead for him will be very bumpy. This is because the kingdom is a long-standing U.S. ally with many powerful friends in Washington. Meanwhile, Saudi petrodollars will definitely not be easy for the Americans to resist.
The Israeli regime is infamous for breaking a long list of international laws, which has drawn worldwide condemnation. Back in 2020, the United Nations General Assembly condemned Israel the most, as it adopted 17 resolutions against Tel Aviv's violation of international laws. That's almost three times more compared with the rest of the world combined, standing at six. The Gaza Strip has been subjected to the longest blockade in modern history. In 2007, Israel imposed a land, sea, and air blockade on Gaza. The inhumane blockade severely restricts imports and exports, people's movements in and out of Gaza, and access to agricultural land and fishing waters, denying Palestinians of their basic human rights. All of these actions are against international law. Israel also demolishes the homes of Palestinians in the occupied Jerusalem Al-Quds and elsewhere in the West Bank in order to provide land for building illegal settlements. According to the United Nations Security Council Resolution 2334, settlements in the occupied West Bank and East Jerusalem Al-Quds are a flagrant violation under international law. Adding to that, Israel frequently targets military positions inside the war-hit Syria, hitting more than 500 spots in the year 2020. Moreover, Israeli aircrafts repeatedly violate Lebanon's airspace on a daily basis, which, again, is a clear violation of international law, in this case, Lebanon's sovereignty. The regime is also the only possessor of nuclear warheads in the region. However, it has always refused to accept or deny having nuclear weapons. Israel has always turned a deaf ear to international calls for nuclear transparency, as it has never allowed inspections of its nuclear facilities and has refrained from joining the Non-Proliferation Treaty. Recently, reports revealed that Tel Aviv was expanding its Dimona nuclear facility, which provides the regime with material needed for its nuclear arsenal. The regime is estimated to have between 100 to 400 atomic warheads. That is while Israel has constantly accused the Islamic Republic of Iran of weaponization of its peaceful nuclear program. Meanwhile, it has carried out several assassination operations against Iranian nuclear scientists over the past decade, all in defiance of international law.
Well, we don't really need the U.S. Claims to for us to believe that Israel is breaking international law. It's been doing that ever since it claimed independence 70 years, more than 70 years ago. So, and it's the worst offender. There's no question that Israel, it's an occupying, it occupies, terrorizes 70 years. No other country. You can think of Myanmar. It was very bad with its Muslims, but not even one tenth of what Israel does really every day.
3 years after former U.S. President Donald Trump's administration withdrew from the United Nations Human Rights Council, his successor Joe Biden has moved to rejoin the panel for the 2022-24 term. Washington walked away from the council during Trump's term in office in 2018, accusing it of displaying hostility toward Israel. That is why Washington's bid to rejoin the Geneva-based rights body is aimed at eliminating the so-called unfair focus on Israel. Meanwhile, Tel Aviv has been widely condemned internationally for its violation of international laws. The occupying regime is routinely on the UN General Assembly's agenda since late 2006 and is condemned for violations, as mentioned, in Gaza and the occupied West Bank. Previously, Biden stated his opposition to the expansion of illegal Israeli settlements in the West Bank. He also said the only way to reach peace between Palestine and Israel is a two-state solution. However, his administration's move to shield Israel against international outcry over its crimes somehow contradicts his earlier remarks about the Palestine-Israel issue.
Of course, it's undermining the UN. The UN's very weak anyway. It's got really no political clout because it's still ruled by the veto in the Security Council, and any reasonable requests and laws are vetoed. So it doesn't really have any clout now. But it does have these committees, and it does get some kind of press coverage, and it has credibility. People don't see the UN as an evil force.
The Israeli regime's malicious acts are not hidden from the eyes of international human rights bodies. However, Washington's attempt does not only seem unfair, but also undermines the UN Rights Council's credibility. When Israel holds the record for the most broken UN resolutions, the credibility of the UN as a rights body comes into question.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
لا إله إلا الله لا إله إلا الله.
Answering your doubts and questions, and questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Allah هو إذا الرحمن.
Allah
هو إذا المنان.
لا إله إلا الله.
Please send us your emails through our email, which is englishradio@irib.ir.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Most Compassionate, the Most Merciful, may Allah's peace and blessings be upon the Holy Prophet of Islam, Muhammad, and his purified progeny. Dear listeners, wherever you are, assalamu alaikum, and welcome to yet another edition from series of Q&A in Islamic Beliefs from IRIB English Radio. In this series of shows, we are trying to answer the questions with regard to theology or whatever goes towards religion and the beliefs of people, specifically the followers of the School of Ahlul Bayt, in order to discuss these issues with scholars from seminary schools. We have invited Sheikh Murtada Karimi to this session. I'd like to welcome Sheikh to the show and say salam to him.
Wa alaikum assalam and thank you for having me.
Thanks for accepting the invitation, Sheikh. Today's question that I want to ask it from the guest speaker of the show, Sheikh Murtada Karimi, is about the Prophet Ibrahim alayhi salam. When he asked Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala just to assure me, show me something to get assured, what does it mean? Does it mean that the Prophet of God was not certain of what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala was saying? Does it nullify his infallibility, or how can we actually collect it and digest it with the concept that an infallible entity never doubts on the power or existence of God? So, Sheikh, what is the reason that the Prophet... That Prophet Ibrahim alayhi salam says, "Liyatma'inna qalbi," just to get assured, show me. Wasn't he certain of what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said so far?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Let me read the verse which talks about this event, that is the verse 260 of chapter Baqarah. A'udhu billahi minash shaitani rajim. وَإِذْ قَالَ إِبْرَاهِيمُ رَبِّ أَرِنِي كَيْفَ تُحْيِي الْمَوْتَى. And when Prophet Ibrahim alayhi salam said, "My Lord, show me how you revive the dead." قَالَ أَوَلَمْ تُؤْمِنْ. Allah said, "Do you not believe?" قَالَ بَلَى وَلَكِنْ لِيَطْمَئِنَّ قَلْبِي. He said, "Yes indeed, but in order that my heart may be at rest." قَالَ فَخُذْ أَرْبَعَةً مِنَ الطَّيْرِ. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala said, "Take four of the birds. فَصُرْهُنَّ إِلَيْكَ ثُمَّ جَعَلْ عَلَى كُلِّ جَبَلٍ مِّنْهُنَّ جُزْءًا. Then cut them into pieces and place a part of them on every mountain. ثُمَّ دَعُهُنَّ يَأْتِينَكَ سَعْيًا. Then call them, they will come to you hastening. وَعْلَمْ أَنَّ اللَّهَ عَزِيزٌ حَكِيمٌ. And know that Allah is Almighty and All-Wise. So some people, as you mentioned, they say that a prophet like Prophet Ibrahim alayhi salam, how come he does not believe in the day of judgment and resurrection, and asks Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to see how Allah is going to revive the dead? And he says that I'm asking for my heart to rest at peace. A great prophet like Prophet Ibrahim alayhi salam, who is one of the five Ulul Azm prophets, He should have that kind of certainty in his heart.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we need to discuss the various dimensions which are related to this event. Now, the first point is that, first of all, Prophet Ibrahim alayhi salam was sure about resurrection and the day of judgment. I refer to some reasons to prove that Prophet Ibrahim alayhi salam did not have any doubt regarding the principle of resurrection and the day of judgment. He was sure about that. The first reason is that when Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is asking him that, "Awalam tu'min," do you not believe? He says that, "Of course I believe. Bala walakin liyatma'inna qalbi." So very explicitly Prophet Ibrahim alayhi salam mentions that I do believe in the day of judgment and resurrection.
Mm-hmm.
The second reason is that when Prophet Ibrahim alayhi salam is talking to the idol worshippers, he refers to his belief, his firm belief in the day of judgment. For example, in chapter Ash-Shu'ara verses 81 and 82, Prophet Ibrahim alayhi salam talks about Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and says, "Walladhi yumituni thumma yuhyin." Allah is the one who caused me to die and then he revives me. "Walladhi atma'u an yaghfira li khati'ati yawm ad-din." And I hope that God, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, will forgive me yawm ad-din, on the day of judgment. And also he said that, "Rabbana ighfir li wa liwalidayya wa lilmu'minina yawma yaqumul hisab." O Allah, on the day of judgment, forgive me, my parents, and all the believers. This is another reason which tells us that Ibrahim alayhi salam for sure did believe in the day of judgment.
Mm-hmm.
And there are many narrations in this regard as well. For example, it was asked from Imam al-Ridha alayhi salam that, "Akana fi qalbihi shak." Was there any doubt in the heart of Prophet Ibrahim alayhi salam regarding the day of judgment and resurrection? قال الله. He said no. ولكن أراد من الله الزيادة في يقينه. He wanted a kind of increase in his certainty, which inshallah I'm going to explain.
True.
And the next reason that proves that Prophet Ibrahim alayhi salam did believe in the day of judgment is that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala tells him that take four birds and make them into pieces and do the following. But finally, Ibrahim is asked to call the birds. So if Ibrahim alayhi salam had any doubt about the resurrection, it could be done by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. So Allah could say that, "Look at these four birds, I'm going to revive them." And Ibrahim alayhi salam, I mean, only needed to see. But here we see that it is done by Ibrahim alayhi salam, not by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. If Ibrahim alayhi salam had any doubt about the power of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala for resurrecting and reviving the dead, it was not necessary for him to do that and to call those birds. It was enough for Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to do that and to show his power. So all these reasons tell us that Ibrahim alayhi salam for sure did believe in the Day of Judgment and resurrection. So why he is asking Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to show him? There are different answers by Muslims and especially the Shia scholars.
Yeah.
The first answer is that in this verse, what Prophet Ibrahim alayhi salam is asking is kayfa tuhyi al-mauta, not kayfa tahyi al-mauta. Kayfa tahyi al-mauta is how the dead people are going to be revived, which means that I'm not sure about the resurrection. This is not the case. He says, kayfa tuhyi al-mauta, how you, O Allah, are going to revive the dead, which means that I do believe in the Day of Judgment, but I want to see the howness. The question is about kayfa, the howness of the deed.
Mm-hmm.
It's not about the deed in and of itself. So there is no doubt in the heart of Prophet Ibrahim alayhi salam regarding the very fact that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is able to revive the dead people. The only question that he has is that he needs to know about kayfiyya, the howness, the quality of this phenomenon and procedure on the Day of Judgment. So this is the explanation which mentioned by some of the Shia scholars. I think especially Allama Tabatabai and Ayatollah Javadi Amali, one of the contemporary Shia scholars. The next point is that when Prophet Ibrahim alayhi salam says liyatma'inna qalbi, he is referring to different levels of certainty. We know that, for example, we have ilmul yaqin, we have aynul yaqin, and then we have haqqul yaqin. There are different levels of certainty. So, according to some scholars, what Ibrahim alayhi salam is looking for is a kind of increase in certainty about kayfiyya, about the quality. So already he knows about that by rational arguments, but now he wants to see. You know, the example is that when you see a smoke from, a far place, ilmul yaqin means that through the smoke you come to this conclusion that there is a kind of fire in that place. This is ilmul yaqin. Aynul yaqin means that no, you not only you know that, you witness that. You go to that place and you see that there is a kind of fire. This is aynul yaqin. But haqqul yaqin is that you touch the fire with your hand and you feel that this is fire. This is haqqul yaqeen, the reality of the certainty. So the second explanation of the scholars is that what Ibrahim alayhi salam is looking for is that he already has the knowledge of the certainty, he has aynul yaqeen, but now he wants to see that reality as well. And again, that reality is about the kayfiyya, about the quality of reviving the dead people. So already through the intellectual reasonings, he knows that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is able. But when he's able to see, then the level of his certainty increases from ilmul yaqeen and aynul yaqeen and comes to haqqul yaqeen. The next point, which is mentioned by some of the scholars, is that they refer to the occasion of the revelation. According to some narrations, Prophet Ibrahim alayhi salam saw a corpse of a dead animal, and it was eaten by different animals and birds. And they say that this question came to the mind of Prophet Ibrahim alayhi salam, that a corpse is eaten by other animals and birds. So how Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is going to put together the body parts of this animal, or human beings, which is eaten by other animals. This is famous as the Shubha, or the doubt of Akil and Ma'kul, which means that, for example, imagine a human being is dead, and then his body parts, his corpse, is eaten by other animals or even by other human beings, and become, and it becomes a part of their flesh and body.
Yeah.
So on the Day of Judgment, how Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is going to create two human beings? A part of them is shared by two people, the one who was dead and the one who ate from the corpse. This is famous as the doubt of Akil and Ma'kul, and there are different answers to that.
Mm-hmm.
So these scholars believe that what Ibrahim alayhi salam asked Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is about this doubt especially, not about the resurrection, in and of itself. He wanted to know that how, when a human being is eaten by other animals or human beings, then what is the way for Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to create that human being again? Because
but Sheikh, what is understood from the surface of the verse of the Holy Quran, this shubha cannot be taken, at least at the first look. Whatever it can be actually taken is that he does not have that certainty on the concept. At least the wording shows that. Am I right?
I'm referring to different answers. For myself, the first answer is the best one, the fact that Ibrahim alayhi salam is asking about kayfiyya,
mm-hmm.
and the howness and the quality, and not the very act of resurrection. He's sure about that. I'm just trying to mention some other possibilities mentioned by various Sunni and Shia scholars.
Mm-hmm.
They refer to the occasion of the revelation. There is a narration about that. Referring to that occasion of the revelation, I mean the story beyond the question of Prophet Ibrahim alayhi salam, they have proposed that the doubt of Prophet Ibrahim alayhi salam was about the doubt of Akil and Ma'kul,
mm-hmm.
and it was his question.
So
at least there is a possibility, and
very true. Can since the interpretation of Quran should be taken from the speaking Qurans, Quran and Natiq, so definitely we refer to the words of Ahlul Bayt and the Imams and the Holy Prophet. To understand what the reality of interpretation of these verses of the Holy Quran are. So, based on the interpretation, what the respected guest speaker said is definitely true, and we, inshallah, we take this aspect of it to understand this verse of the Holy Quran. Thank you very much, dear brothers and sisters, for listening to Q&A on Islamic Beliefs from IRB English Radio. I live in Allah's protection till our next session. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Inna fil jannati nahran laban. Inna fil jannati nahran laban. Li Ali wa Hussein wa Hassan. لعلي وحسين وحسان إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسان لعلي وحسين وحسان حب أهل البيت فرض عندنا حب أهل البيت فرض عندنا وبهذا الحب لا نخشى المحن
IRIB English Radio